Chapter 12. Queen Isabella, the Inspired Crusader. Our debt to the great Queen of Castile and Leon is hard to measure, but in any case it is phenomenal. This remarkable woman was possessed of some of the finest qualities that we can be proud of as being characteristic of our great white race. Even as a child, she was endowed with a serene self-possession and had a majestic presence. This was not surprising, perhaps, considering that she was descended from Alfred the Great, William the Conqueror, the Plantagenet kings of England, St. Louis, king of France, and St. Fernando, king of Castile. Like her ancestors, William the Conqueror and Henry II, she was possessed of an iron will, which, once it had marked out an objective, was not easily turned aside. She liked to listen rather than talk, and when she spoke, it was briefly and to the point. In order to understand the tremendous accomplishments of this unusual woman, and the tremendous role she played in changing the manifold destiny in the course of history, it is important to understand the times in which she lived. It is also important to understand the several centuries preceding her reign, and the jeopardy in which the Mohammedan Moors and the Jews had not only placed Spain, but all of white Europe. We have already considered in a previous chapter how the Jews were instrumental in creating and promoting a new religion among the Arabs, and how in their diabolical cunning they were planning to weld a mighty Muslim empire and then use this new battering ram to invade, conquer, and destroy white Europe. After the Muslims, by force of the sword, had conquered and converted all the Arab tribes along the northern shores of Africa to the gates of Gibraltar, it was the Spanish Jews who invited the Saracens to cross over into Spain. When in 709 the Saracens finally came, at the instigation of the African Jews, it was the Spanish Jews that were able to open the gates to the conquerors and were rewarded by being made rulers of Granada, Seville, and Cordova. In the new Muslim state, the Jews attained a brilliant height of prosperity and influence. This the Jews managed to accomplish even after the discovery that they were plotting to bring the Arabs from Africa to overthrow the Gothic kingdom, later Spain, and even after they were condemned to slavery, and even after their liberation, they were repressed by the provisions of the strict Visigothic code. In spite of all this, they prospered, and by the beginning of the 8th century, they were so rich and powerful in all the principal cities of Spain that they were able to betray that unfortunate country and continue to open the gates further for the fanatic Moorish invaders. The gradual reconquest by the white Spaniards of the peninsula itself did not particularly disturb the Jews. When St. Fernando recaptured Seville in 1224, he was foolish enough to give them 4 Moorish mosques to convert into synagogues. He allowed them one of the more pleasant sections of the city for their homes, and demanded only that they refrain from insulting the Christian religion and from making converts among the Christians. The Jews observed none of these conditions, of course, yet several of the later kings, especially those in need of money, showed them high favor, and Alfonso VIII made a Jew his treasurer. Here we see this eternal foolish weakness of the white kings willingly collaborating with their deadly enemies, the Jews, and giving them financial powers to collect the taxes of their subjects. We see this very same sickness in America. In the last decade, we ourselves have had 2 Jewish directors of Internal Revenue, one by the name of Cohen and one by the name of Kaplan. Toward the end of the 13th century, the Jews were so powerful in Spain that they had almost brought the Spanish reconquest of the Moors to an end. There must have been in all of Spain somewhere between 4 and 6 million Jews out of a total population of 25 to 30 million. In other words, approximately 15 to 20% were Jews. There was, furthermore, at this time, a program of subversion of the Christian doctrine by a group called the Albigenses, a sect, again created by Jews, who taught outright self-destruction and suicide as a creed, a further perversion of the brain to speed the destruction of the white race. Even some non-Jews had themselves circumcised, so that they might teach freely as Jews this heresy, for which they might have been punished as Christians. Furthermore, the Catholic Church, foolishly, had always regarded usury as a sin, leaving the field of money lending wide open to the Jews, who thereby had a monopoly as the only bankers and money lenders. Little by little, the capital and commerce of the country passed into their hands. They generally charged 20% interest in Aragon and 33 1/3% in Castile. During the famine of 1326, they demanded 40% interest on money lent to the town of Cuenca to buy wheat. The citizen with taxes to pay, the farmer with no money to buy wheat for his planting, and the burgher held for ransom by robber baron, turned in desperation to the Jewish money lender and became his economic slave. By lending money to the kings, the Jews also acquired control of the government. The common people hated them because they were often bought from the king the privilege of taxation, and mercilessly wrung all the money they could from the unfortunate citizens. Now and then, the Spaniards reacted in a healthy, instinctive way. When things got too desperate, the citizens would simply rise up and massacre a good number of the Jews. In most cases, the Pope would come to the defense of the Jews and do his utmost to stop the citizens in their righteous indignation from massacring the Jews, a further proof that Christianity was Jewish in its instigation and continues to be Jewish in its control from the central domination of the Pope himself. When the Black Death slew half the population of Europe in 2 years. The Jews suffered worse than the rest, for the desperate populace accused them of having caused the pestilence by poisoning the wells, and commenced to slay them all over Europe. There is much evidence that the Jews did in fact drop infected people in wells and other sources of water in order to spread the plague and thereby kill off more of the white population. Pope Clement VI denounced these accusations against the Jews as lies, trying to point out that the plague had been just as deadly in lands where no Jews lived, although this was not easily proved or disproved. He further strongly threatened to excommunicate such people as took part in these massacres, calling them fanatics. Nevertheless, the Spaniards continued to kill the Jews. In Castile, in 1391, several thousand were massacred. As a result, many Jews seemingly embraced Christianity and became known as conversos or Maranos. Thus came into being a new class of Jewish Christians, some of whom were seemingly sincere, but most of whom, while attending Mass on Sunday, secretly continued to attend the synagogue and to eat kosher food. Thus, as professing Christians, the secret Jews were now freed from the restrictions imposed upon their brothers of the synagogue, and could intermarry with any of the leading families of Spain. Furthermore, a new and highly important field was opened up to them, for as Christians, they could now become priests or dedicate their sons to the church to show their loyalty to their new religion, with the result that in Isabella's time, they controlled and exploited the Catholic Church in Spain to an astonishing degree. There were in Spain many Catholic priests who were secretly Jews and made a mockery of the Mass and of the sacraments they pretended to administer. One such priest, for example, never gave absolution when he heard confessions. The Spanish Catholics naturally resented these sacrileges bitterly, and for good reason blame the Jews exclusively for the prevalent corruption in the church. In fact, the old Christians, that is the Spaniards, detested the conversos even more than the Jews of the synagogue, whom they at least could identify. Many of these conversos made a mockery of the sacraments, and when they went to confession, they usually lied to the confessor. The Jews had Spain under their heel and were having a field day, robbing and feasting their victims. This was pretty much the situation politically and religiously in Spain when Isabella, at the age of 10, was being brought to the court of her half-brother, 26 years her senior. He was now Enrique IV, King of Castile. When Isabella's father had died, Enrique inherited the throne. Isabella was a beautiful girl of the fairer Nordic type, with light reddish hair, a determined chin, somewhat too large for her other features, and blue eyes, in which there were greenish lights flecked with gold. She received a good education, not unlike the daughters of noblemen in Spain of that period. She had learned to speak Castilian musically and with elegance, and to write it with a touch of distinction. She studied grammar, rhetoric, painting, poetry, history, and philosophy. From her father, she inherited a passionate love for music and for poetry, and from her tutors, who had studied at Salamanca University, she had learned much of the philosophy of Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. When she and her younger brother Alfonso were brought to the court of Enrique IV, they were shocked to see the immorality and the treachery that was going on at the Castilian court. The weak and profligate Enrique was a disgrace to his throne and a traitor to the white race. Archbishop Carrillo of Toledo accused King Enrique as follows: "The abomination and corruption of sins so heinous that they are not fit to be named, for they corrupt the very atmosphere and are a foul blot upon human nature." The archbishop joined other discontented nobles at Burgos in drawing up a series of memorable accusations publicly addressed to the king. They declared that the king's Moorish guard and others to whom he had given power had raped married women and corrupted and violated virgins and men and boys against nature, and good Christians who dared complain were being publicly whipped. They charged that the king had destroyed the property of the Spanish laboring classes by allowing Moors and Jews to exploit them, that he had caused prices to rise unreasonably by debasing the currency, that he had allowed his officials to practice bribery and extortion on a huge scale, that he had made a mockery of justice and government by vicious appointments and by allowing hideous crimes to go unpunished, that he had corrupted the church by casting good bishops out of their sees, replacing them with hypocrites and politicians. To the credit of both Isabella and her brother, Prince Alfonso, it was generally agreed that they walked through this fetid atmosphere of foul court without contamination, and emerged from it with a lifelong hatred of the prevalent immorality and of its causes, among which they reckoned the influence of Muslims and Jews. There were many intrigues at court, and revolutions and battle flaring up throughout the kingdom. Isabella's brother, Prince Alfonso, was first in line for the throne. However, when he was 15 years of age, he died suddenly. Some accused King Enrique or his followers of poisoning him, but this is not certain. Isabella became a valuable political pawn, and many intrigues were in progress to have her married to various political alliances. King Enrique attempted to marry off the princess as soon as possible to King Alfonso V of Portugal, who was anxious to obtain Isabella's consent. Another suitor at this time was the Duke of Guyenne, brother and heir apparent of King Louis XI of France, also determined and intent upon marrying her, was a Jewish mulatto of unsavory reputation, by the name of Don Pedro Giron, who had obtained the king's consent. Fortunately, while this lecherous character was on his way, determined to marry Isabella against her will, he became desperately sick and died. Princess Isabella received the news of his death with tears of joy and gratitude, and hastened to the chapel to give thanks to God. Having survived all these, when she was 18 years old, she married Prince Fernando the heir apparent to the throne of Aragon. Don Fernando was a manly youth, almost a year younger than she. In their union loomed the prospect of uniting the great kingdoms of Castile and Aragon into one of the most powerful nations in Europe. Many enemies, including her half-brother, King Enrique, fought the prospect of such an alliance. Nevertheless, her marriage, which had to be secret, when it became known, became an established fact which King Enrique was powerless to undo. Isabella's half-brother, King Enrique, died on December the 12th, 1474. Amid the joy and jubilation of her new subjects, and amidst great pomp and ceremony, Isabella was crowned Queen of Castile on the 13th day of December that same year. She was then 23 years old, a beautiful and stately figure. Her husband, Prince Fernando, was not at her side at the time. When he learned the news of Enrico's death and of his wife's coronation, he was in Perpignan, where he had gone early in the autumn to save his father from capture by his enemies. The queen and her husband had a strict understanding about their regal prerogatives. Queen Isabella was to be the sole and supreme ruler of the Kingdom of Castile, and when Fernando came to the throne, he was to be in the same capacity over the King of Aragon. Many were the intrigues, the gossip, the controversies amongst their followers and enemies to divide the court into two factions, but they were not successful. Henceforth, in most public affairs, they were to act as one person, both signatures on all documents, both faces on all coins. Even if necessity parted them, love held their wills in unison. Many persons tried to divide them, but they were resolved not to disagree. They could not afford to have differences if they wished to accomplish the gigantic task that awaited them, to bring order out of anarchy, to restore the prestige of the crown, to recover from robber barons crown lands illegally granted them by Enrique, to deflate the currency and restore prosperity to the farms and industry, to settle the Jewish problem, the Moorish problem, the Converso problem. This was a task that seemed impossible for a young woman and a young man with neither troops nor money. France and Portugal were their enemies. Castile was a state of chaos. The situation was amazingly parallel to that which faced that other great leader, Adolf Hitler, when he inherited a bankrupt, divided and broken Germany in 1933. He too had a divided country. He too had a nation that was divided within itself, a nation racked by the Jewish problem and faced with a multitude of enemies on the outside. Although she was unusually fortunate in having a husband that supported her totally in her endeavors, the driving force and the crusading zeal came mainly from Isabella herself. No sooner had Isabella been crowned Queen of Castile when the country was invaded by Alfonso V, King of Portugal. Fernando and Isabella inherited kingdoms that were without troops and without finances to acquire any army. However, Isabella's enemies had failed to reckon upon her awakening genius. For months, she lived almost constantly on horseback, going from one end of the kingdom to the other, making speeches, holding conferences, holding court all morning to sentence a few thieves and murderers to be hanged, riding 100 miles or more over cold mountain passes to plead with some lukewarm nobleman for 500 soldiers. Wherever she went, she stirred into flame the ancient hatred of the Castilians for the Portuguese. While Fernando collected troops from the northern provinces, Isabella assembled several thousand men at Toledo and rode at their head in full armor, like Saint Joan, to meet her husband at Valladolid. By the end of June 1475, they had assembled a motley host of 42,000 men, poorly equipped and badly disciplined, many of them farmhands and released convicts. Whipping them hastily into 35 battalions, Fernando left Valladolid in July and struck southwest to the River Duero. After several months and several battles, during which the fighting raged back and forth, Fernando finally put King Alfonso's forces to rout, thereby ending, for the time being, the threat from Portugal and King Alfonso V's claims to Isabella's throne of Castile. The victory over Portugal left Isabella undisputed mistress of Castile, but it was a Castile ridden with famine and pestilence, and economically almost beyond repair. No one paid their debts, and there was no means of enforcing them to be paid. Disorder was the usual course of events. Peaceful men were not masters of their own property. They had no recourse to anybody for the robberies and the acts of violence they endured. The chief task that confronted Isabella and Fernando now was to restore respect for law. To do this, Isabella and her husband rode from town to town, sometimes together, sometimes separately, administering justice without delay and without cost to the people. The young queen would hear complaints, order reconciliations and restitutions, condemn the guilty to death, and ride on to the next place. Within a short time, her justice had filled the country with consternation. It was the more terrifying because it was felt to be impartial and incorruptible. A great deal of the corruption was among the wealthy nobles themselves, and, as had been their practice formerly, they offered the queen enormous sums of money in order to bribe her from enforcing her strict justice. But the queen preferred justice to money. For instance, when a wealthy noble named Alvar Yanez, who had murdered a notary, offered the queen the enormous sum of 40,000 ducats if she would spare his life, she emphatically refused, and had the head of Yanez struck off the same day. In order to avoid any suspicion of mercenary motives, she had the property distributed among his sons, although there was plenty of precedence in justifying her to have it confiscated. Isabella and Fernando were only too well aware of the fact that the Mohammedans, who occupied the southern half of Spain, were assembling forces to again invade and conquer the northern half of that divided country. They were also only too well aware that their own forces were scattered, divided, and pitifully weak to meet such an invasion. She knew that there were several other primary prerequisites that had to be corrected before the country could be unified enough to meet such an invasion. The church itself was thoroughly corrupted and stuffed with converso Jews that were in key positions to spread anarchy and confusion during any stress or strain that developed. Her half-brother, King Enrique, had given away and forfeited so many crown lands that revenue was almost non-existent for shoring up the royal treasury. They therefore felt that two further necessary steps, harsh though they be, had to be taken in order to unite the country and enforce the supreme authority of the crown. Since the Catholic Church wielded tremendous power in Spain during the 15th century, the king and queen knew that they had to rid the church hierarchy of the deceitful and perfidious converso Jews, who were now posing as Christians, but were ready to sell out the church and their country at the first given opportunity to the Mohammedans. They decided to institute the Inquisition and once and for all cleanse the church of this alien group that was neither Spanish nor was it Christian. Isabella realized that before she could meet the threat of the Moors from the south, she had to overcome the enemies within her own country. Among these enemies, she could count not only the Jews of the synagogue, but the secret Jews, the conversos, who had infiltrated the hierarchy of the church. She knew that it was the Jews who had invited the Mohammedans into the country in the first place, and who had always been considered enemies within the gate, sympathizing with and often lending assistance to the hated Moors. Having secured secretly from the Pope 2 years earlier permission to establish the Inquisition, she and Fernando now proceeded in earnest. The Jews had not only corrupted and contaminated the Catholic Church itself, but they had also originated and spread the Albigensian heresy. This heresy was teaching and practicing suicide on principle, and the followers frequently smothered or starved their sick, and even put infants to death. Here we see another idea and teaching originated and spread by the Jews that would tend to stifle and destroy the white race. It was to meet the questions raised by the Albigenses that the Inquisition was first established. The Inquisition itself never condemned anyone to death. The inquisitors would go to a certain city and summon all heretics to confess within a fixed time, usually within 30 days. Those who did so were treated leniently. A prisoner who was found guilty and refused to abjure was handed over by the inquisitors to the state, which then proceeded against him as a traitor. In practice, about 2 persons out of 100 accused were put to death. Some were imprisoned, some were freed. Torture was used as a last resort, but efforts were made to restrict its use. In the meantime, it became quite evident that the Mohammedans were making a determined attempt to conquer all of Europe. In 1479, Mohammed II, the Grand Turk, advanced by sea to lay waste to the island of Rhodes. When in the next year of 1480, the Knights of St. John at Rhodes repulsed Mohammed II, the latter threw all of Europe into consternation by swooping down upon the shores of Italy. His cruise ravaged the coast of Apulia, and on August 2, 1480, Mohammed took by storm the city of Otranto in the kingdom of Naples. Of the 22,000 inhabitants, the barbarians bound 12,000 with ropes, and thus helpless, put them to death with terrible tortures. They slew all the priests in the city. On a hill outside the city, now known as Martyrs' Hill, they butchered many captives who refused to become Mohammedans, and threw their corpses to the dogs. The apathy of the Italian princes was incredible. Undermined and controlled by Jewish moneylenders, they remained disunited and completely impotent. For example, the King of Naples was at war with Florence, and his son Alfonso, the Duke of Calabria, was 150 leagues away in Tuscany, fighting in the Tuscany War. And so it went. Panic began to sweep over the Spanish kingdoms. Men were asking what would happen if the Turks came from the east and the Moors of Granada took the offensive in the south against Andalusia. Castile was without a doubt on the eve of war, and it would be a war in which she would need every ounce of her strength. And yet there were secret enemies within her gates, enemies who had grown rich upon her wealth in the past, and given evidence of their sympathy with the hated and feared Mohammedans. These enemies were the Jewish conversos in Castile, a nation within a nation. The landings of the Turks in Italy had sealed the doom of the conversos. The first proceedings of the Inquisition in Castile were held February 6, 1481. At the same time, the bubonic plague was raging throughout Spain. The conversos were now thoroughly alarmed, and at last began to flee from Seville. Several of the most powerful conversos met in the Catholic Church of San Salvador to discuss means for protecting themselves. Catholic priests, friars, magistrates, government officials, all of Jewish descent, and secret enemies of the Catholic Church and of Spain itself were present. Diego de Suzan, a rabbi whose fortune was estimated at 10 million maravedis, demanded in a fiery speech that they resist the Inquisition by force. They knew they had the main power of the city in their hands, and they decided to assemble troops and to kill their enemies, and thereby avenge themselves. By a stroke of fortune, Isabella found out about this plot. The chief conspirators were seized. Suzanne and his wealthy accomplices were tried before a jury of lawyers. Several of them confessed and were given penances to perform, whereas six of the ringleaders were declared to be impenitent heretics and were turned over by the inquisitors to the secular officials of the town. The six unrepentant conspirators were taken outside the walls of the city, tied to stakes, and burned. Suzanne's execution was 3 days later. Thousands of conversos now fled in panic in all directions, some to Portugal, some to Italy, where the Jews, in times of persecution, had never failed to find a protector in the Pope. And so it went from city to city. Even the inquisitors were astonished to find how large a percentage of the conversos were engaged in undermining the church itself, to which they professed allegiance, and in intrigues and conspiracies against the crown and the country itself. Wildly exaggerated accounts of the Spanish Inquisition have been circulated during the past 5 centuries by writers hostile to Spain and to the Catholic Church. The truth seems to be that in all of Isabella's reign, about 2,000 persons, including not only secret Jews, but bigamists, blasphemers, church robbers, false mystics, and other offenders, were burned. Public opinion undoubtedly approved of the Inquisition, and Isabella herself always referred to it with pride. Jewish writers in the last 5 centuries, who have dominated our literature, have accused Isabella of having brought about the intellectual decay of Spain because of the Inquisition. This, of course, is a great big lie, for the intellectual life of Spain was never more vigorous than in the century after she established the Inquisition. It was the period of her 3 greatest poets, Cervantes, Lope de Vega, and Calderon, the golden age of her literature. It was the period when her finest schools and universities were established, while foreign scholars flocked to Spain and were honored, and medicine and other sciences made their most notable gains. Never were the industries and commerce of Spain so prosperous, and never was order so well maintained at home and prestige abroad as high as during the 16th century, when Spain became the head of a new empire that overshadowed all Europe and the Americas. There is little doubt that the main cause of this great resurgence of Spain was her partial cleansing herself of the Jewish pestilence in her midst. This internal house-cleaning came none too soon. The Mohammedans were determined to make an attempt to conquer all of Europe. That wily Moor, Muley Abu Hassan, Muslim leader of Granada, had taken by storm the town of Zahara on Christmas Day, 1482, and was within 15 miles southwest of Seville. Whether Isabella liked it or not, she was faced with the greatest crisis of her life, and as was characteristic of her, she was determined to fight. Isabella was now resolved to end Moorish domination in the south, no matter how long it might take. What all good Castilian kings had dreamed of doing, what her father had failed to do, and weaklings like Enrique had neglected to do, she proposed, with the help of her husband, Fernando, to accomplish. The king would lead the Spanish host in the crusade, and she, in her magnificent prime at 30, would be recruiting agent, commissary, purchaser of munitions, field nurse, and propaganda bureau, all in one. It is not my purpose here to review the bloody events of the war that ensued over the next 10 years. There were many discouraging defeats, and many times when she was on the verge of despair. In fact, the ensuing war was of such a nature that it would have broken many a spirit. But with her iron determination, she pursued the war relentlessly. At the same time, she pressed the campaign against the converse Jews. But for the Inquisition and its funds, the prosecution of the war would have been hopeless. This was the new age of gunpowder and cannon. To wage this war, heavy artillery would be needed, and that must come from France, Germany, and Italy. She did the only possible thing by confiscating the property of the converso Jews. She utilized this revenue with which to buy the munitions of war and other supplies needed to wage war against the Moors. Not only did she wage war against the treacherous conversos and against the aggressive Moors, but by the time the victory against the Moors was completed, she had given birth to her fifth child. Also, during those war years, Isabella began to study Latin, so that she might understand foreign diplomats without having to depend upon interpreters. The courage, the zeal, and determination of Isabella and her husband finally paid off. After 10 years, the war was over, and on January the 2nd, 1492, the Moorish leader, Boabdil, came forth, surrendered Granada, and handed the keys of the city to King Fernando, who in turn gave them to the queen, who then passed them on to her oldest son, Prince Juan. Presently, the silver cross of the crusade appeared on the high tower of the city of Granada, with the flag of Santiago beside it. Was the first time that the white race had ruled the city of Granada in 770 years. The year 1492 was a great year for Spain, for Isabella, and for the white race. It was the year that the Moors were driven out of Spain. It was the year that Christopher Columbus, under the auspices of King Fernando and Queen Isabella, set out for the New World and discovered America. It was also the year that the royal couple of Spain made a determined decision to rid the country of the other part of that treacherous foe, the synagogue Jews. By instituting the Inquisition, Isabella had been mainly concerned with protecting the Catholic Church and driving out the secret Jews from the hierarchy and membership of the church. To a large degree, she had been successful in this. However, this had not at all affected the synagogue Jews, namely, the Jews who stayed loyal to their Judaic faith. She found that they were still ravishing the country to a large degree, betraying Spain to the Moors and the Muslims at every turn, and still in possession of a tremendous amount of wealth and power, all to the detriment of her beloved country. Not only that, but they were continually stirring up the newly converted converso Jews to acts of sacrilege and offences against the church. Bernaldez, the Spanish historian of the time, writes about the Jews. They, the Jews, live mostly in the larger cities and in the most wealthy and prosperous and fertile lands, and all of them were merchants and vendors and had control of the taxing privileges and were the stewards of manors, cloth shearers, tailors, cobblers, leather dealers, curriers, weavers, spicers, peddlers, silk merchants, jewelers, and had other similar occupations. Never did they till the soil, nor were they laborers, nor carpenters, nor masons, but all sought easy occupations and ways of making money with little work. They were cunning people. Fernando and Isabella finally decided that the Jews were the ruination of Spain, and that nothing would remove the root of the trouble but to drive them from the kingdom. On the last day in March 1492, they issued an edict ordering all Jews to leave their kingdom, and on or before July 1st, taking with them no gold, silver, or minted money. On August 2nd, the day before Columbus sailed for America, the Jews had to leave unless they were baptized and converted to Christianity. About 160,000 Jews appear to have left Spain. Some sailed for Catania, Africa, and some went to Arcilla, and from there on to Fez in the Moorish kingdoms of Africa. Others proceeded to Portugal and were allowed, on payment of a large tax, to enter. Some went to Navarre, France. Others struggled as far as the Balkans. Some returned to Castile and were baptized. There remained, however, a large number of persons of Jewish descent, possibly as many as 3 or 4 million, who had been baptized as Christians. Many of them were received by Pope Alexander VI as refugees in Rome. It seems that the Jews could always count on the Pope to save their neck when things became intolerable in the countries that they had ravaged. This is not too strange, considering that the Jews had invented Christianity in the first place, and without a doubt remained in control of the papacy in Rome over the centuries that followed. They are, in fact, in firm control of the Catholic Church today, using it as a tool wherewith to blunt and pervert the healthy native instincts of the white race. For his aid and help to the Jews at this time, Pope Alexander VI, who was born in Spain, was contemptuously referred to in his native land as the Marano and the Jew. Queen Isabella lived for another 12 years after the historic year of 1492. During this time, many more honors were heaped upon her, and she also experienced many heartbreaks within the circle of her own family. I am, however, going to leave the story of Isabella at this point, since her most significant work had now been done. Her life story stands forth as a blazing epoch in the history of the white race. But for her, it is very probable that Europe would have been overrun by the black Muslims of Africa and would today be a bastardized race of mulattoes. Her genius, her zeal, and her determination stand as a beacon for all members of the white race, both men and women, to exalt and to try to emulate. We have much to learn from the history of her struggles, both from what she accomplished, from what she failed to do, and the mistakes she made. Her accomplishments are a vast inspiration to all members of the white race, and we can be tremendously proud of this great woman. Her life story proves to us that when our white race seems to have reached bottom when the Jews seem to have completely destroyed every shred of decency and corrupted the government, the country, and all other institutions. And when things seem desperate and hopeless, the will, the genius, and the determination of one single person can, in one lifetime, change the situation from the lowest depths of despair to one of grandeur, pride, and prosperity. We have seen how Spain was racked with crime, internal division, starvation, pestilence, and direly threatened by enemies within and also without her borders. We have seen how corruption had eroded the country from the highest office of the land, the throne, down to the lowest burgher in the village. We have seen how the black Moors of Africa had conquered and usurped the southern half of Spain and were threatening not only the rest of Spain, but all of Europe. At 23 years of age, Queen Isabella could hardly have faced a more helpless and desperate situation. Nevertheless, in the next 20 years of her reign, by her indomitable will, her courage, and her determination, she conquered all these evils. She overcame them, and she restored Spain, not only to her highest former grandeur, but brought Spain to new heights never before attained. Not only did Spain reach the greatest heights in her history during Isabella's reign up to that time, but went on in the next century, partially purged of the Jews, to become the greatest power in Europe, to build a mighty empire in the New World, and to bring her art, literature, and commerce to heights never before achieved by any other country of Europe. We have much to learn from her mistakes also. Her greatest mistake was her devotion to the Christian religion instead of realizing the basic value of her great racial heritage. She was able to accomplish what she did not because of any religious guidelines, but because of the quality of the blood that flowed in her royal veins. Because of her addiction to Christianity, she allowed the Jewish-dominated papacy again and again to thwart her determination to take the stringent measures necessary to totally rid her country of the Jewish pestilence. And in this whole question, she made the fatal error of regarding the Jews as a religion rather than the parasitic race that they are. She made the fatal mistake of allowing them to deceitfully profess Christianity and in trying to convert them instead of purging and expunging them from the country. She also made the sad mistake of allowing the Moors, once they were conquered, to remain in Spain, trying to convert them to Christianity, or allowing them to become peaceful citizens of her country. What she should have done is drive every last one of them out across the Mediterranean and back to Africa, so that they would not then, nor in future generations, pollute the blood of Spain. She made the unforgivable mistake of allowing 3 or 4 million Jews who deceitfully profess Christianity but secretly remain Jews at heart to remain in Spain. She should have exterminated the Jewish problem completely by doing to those Jews that remain conversos the same as was done to those proven guilty in the Inquisition, or driving them from the realm. Having gathered the power and momentum to purge and cleanse the country of these treacherous alien elements, the Jews and the Moors, she should have done the job completely and thoroughly. As it was, she allowed millions of these Semites, both Moors and Jews, to remain in her country and contaminate and pollute the blood of the Spanish race further than it already had been. Centuries of Spaniards have been paying a heavy price for this mistake, and today Spain itself is inhabited by a mongrelized race with a heavy Moorish and Jewish contamination flowing in the veins of her people. From this, she can never recover. Despite their pretended conversion, the Jews remain Jews, remaining there to forever betray and conspire with Spain's enemies. In collaboration with the Jews of England and France and other countries, they endeavored over the next few centuries to stifle and stymie the trade and the expansion of Spain as much as possible, and in numerous cases betrayed secrets to her enemies through the Jewish grapevine. To her credit, however, it must be said of Isabella that she did not bring about these conditions. The Jews had heavily infested Spain more than a dozen centuries before she ever came to the throne. The Muslims had already overrun Spain many centuries before she was ever born, and still occupied half of Spain at the time when she was crowned queen. But for her determination and her zeal, they undoubtedly would have caused a grave further degeneration of Spain, and undoubtedly helped the Arabs and the Muslims to overrun the rest of Spain, and most probably all of Europe. And beyond a shadow of doubt, this great queen did set back and retard the Jewish and Muslim advance by many centuries. Above all, and this we should note well, she proved to us all what one determined white person can do by zeal and determination. By organization and leadership, the Jewish power can be broken. She did this in her lifetime, as Adolf Hitler did it in his lifetime. Let this be a tremendous inspiration to us all. Let us do likewise in our own time, in our own generation.